but we understood that several people had died trying to do that, tempted by its apparent placidness. It was known to Nobo hikers as a kind of lock on the last door into the final push, and you couldn't open it without a key, or a crowbar. Luckily, my A-team crew was already on top of this. They found the canoes stashed by the river for us and paddled across. "We live in Maine," John said. "If we don't know how to paddle canoes, we don't deserve to be here." When we got across, the last strategic meeting before entering the southern end of the 100-mile wilderness was convened with lightning speed. Walter and Ralsti would run the first leg of the wilderness with me, so they helped the trail monsters throw the gear we'd need into their packs, keeping mine as light as possible. The 100-mile wilderness was like nothing that had come before it. For starters, it had the strange distinction of being a gated section of the trail, a wilderness that could be accessed by a labyrinth of logging roads with trapdoors. The gated roads had hard open and closed hours, which meant that my crew wasn't just running according to one schedule, ours. We were running on someone else's. It was a life-size video game that required precision skill and a lot of luck. At the entrance of the 100-mile wilderness stood a sign that read, "Caution. There are no places to obtain supplies or get help until Able Bridge, 100 miles north. Do not attempt this section unless you have a minimum of 10 days' supplies and are fully equipped. This is the longest wilderness section of the entire AT, and its difficulty should not be underestimated. Good hiking." In 2013, a 66-year-old woman named Geraldine Largay veered slightly off the trail in Maine after hiking 1,000 miles north from Harper's Ferry in Virginia. Her body was found less than 2 miles from the trail. She had wandered lost for 26 days before dying of starvation. She left a note in a Ziploc bag. It said, "When you find my body, please call my husband George and my daughter Carrie. It will be the greatest kindness for them to know that I am dead and where you found me, no matter how many years from now." The woods were so thick that her body wasn't found for 2 years. We had 2 days and a few hours left. Every minute we could save would come back to us tenfold. The trail began by bobbing up and down, making it nearly impossible for anyone to fall into a steady stride. Every hour, it seemed, we climbed 1,000 feet over uneven piles of broken boulders, hopping over knife-edged rocks, and struggling not to bruise and scratch our ankles and legs. The landscape, strewn with giant stones, looked like the site of a major earthquake. Then we'd go down at least 1,000 feet at a time. The trail sank into marshes and swamps with roots that reached up to our shins, forcing us into awkward stutter steps and causing plenty of falls. Having Ralsti around really did make me feel better. His mere presence was a constant reminder of just how much a body and mind could endure without breaking. Not only had he gone 127 hours without sleep, he'd cut off his arm without anesthesia. And apparently, he hadn't suffered any lasting damage to his nerves, brain, or major organs. He was still extremely athletic, seemed to suffer no post-traumatic stress symptoms, and he didn't avoid taking calculated risks. I mean, he was out here after all. I knew that Ralsti was a good alpine skier, climber, and mountaineer, but I'd never known how supernaturally sure-footed he was until, as we were trying to make up time on a sharp descent, hopping and skipping over jagged rocks, he started reading a lengthy article to me on his phone to keep my mind awake. He read the whole thing, not even pausing, as he leaped from rock to rock like a mountain goat. But Ralsti, like Horty and the Speed Goat, and many of my other friends, was full of contradictions. Maybe it's an ultra-runner thing. Maybe it's a human thing. In any case, my friends could sure be peculiar. Case in point, here was a man who'd endured something most people can't even imagine. Yet he didn't like getting dirty. He would take off his shoes and socks every time we crossed a stream, so he wouldn't get sand in them. And he insisted on bathing as thoroughly as possible whenever it was even remotely feasible. Meanwhile, I was beginning to look semi-decomposed. Timmy, who was friends with Ralsei from their many wilderness outings, curiously maintained that anyone who declares a war on dust obviously has too much time on their hand. With Ralsei setting the pace, we seized every opportunity the trail gave us to open up and run. The afternoon stretched on for what felt like an eternity, before suddenly sinking into the soft glow of twilight. We put on our headlamps as the deep woods' darkness brought the stars into stark relief, their points glittering so brightly that they looked almost artificial in their clarity. We ran into day 46 and beyond. The sun rose, my hands were shaking, my bones protruded. At 5 a.m., we officially had 36 hours to break the record. I was 63 miles from the end of the line. Later in the afternoon, Ralsei and I took a short side trail to reach the peaceful shores of Pemadumcook Lake. And finally, there it was, the destination of this perpetual odyssey, Katahdin. When I saw it for the first time, the realization was like suddenly seeing the glow from a lighthouse after floating hopelessly lost at sea. Salvation. It hit me like a rogue wave. It was real and it was near. Near enough. 48 miles to be exact. We were about to find out if I had any Alvinado left. If the webwalker could break through the internal webs that had covered my fighting spirit. Jalu and Walter came out to do 8 miles with me before the next crossing. I recall them running ahead and talking about how slow I was going as if I weren't there, the way you might talk about a baby or someone confused by dementia. I wasn't resentful. I understood. I was locked in a purgatory between dreamland and reality, and couldn't function properly in either. In addition to my hands and eyes and skin and bones all giving out, now my back suddenly decided to malfunction in a strange and horrible way. It spasmed and seized up almost constantly. For the first time, I didn't feel like I was merely in pain. I felt like I was actually losing my own body, like someone or something else was taking over. More than the FKT, more than Katahdin, I just wanted to feel justified, even if that meant using up my body completely. The night descended for the last time on my journey. It was 9 p.m. on day 46, and we were 32 miles from Katahdin. At Pollywog stream crossing, my crew was wearing what looked like hazmat suits made out of bug netting because of the mosquitoes and biting flies. I didn't even notice the carnage the insects were inflicting on my bare skin. I knew I had one more opportunity to sleep before we made the final push. I also knew I couldn't sleep just yet. Tophet scheduled 17 more miles that night, but I couldn't do it. Topher and Chrissy were packed and ready for the night shift, and they had all my stuff ready to go. Then my body just stopped working. I felt it coming on before it fully hit. "Toph," I said, "I need to sleep here. I've got to stop. We can make up the difference tomorrow." "Scott, I promise you, we'll let you sleep, but let's get to Golden Road, and then you can get a solid 4 hours." I threw up my hands and tried saying no, but he quickly handed me a cup of cold instant coffee, and I choked it down. I needed high-grade pharmaceuticals, or a Breaking Bad barista, but the only other stimulant we had was yerba mate. Nothing put a dent in my sleepiness. I suddenly got a crazy spasm in the middle of my back, and couldn't stay upright. I hunched over while Chrissy tried to massage it enough for me to stand. I felt like my whole body was breaking down, and whatever strength I was squeezing out of it now was the last I had. I had no idea what would happen when that was gone. I was all out of hidden reservoirs. There were no untapped resources. We got to the crossing at Golden Road, near the base of Katahdin, at about 4:45 a.m. I'd done 47.6 miles that day. In the 4 days immediately following Galehead, I'd averaged 28 miles a day. In the 5 days since then, I'd averaged 46. Not because I had any speed left. I didn't. but because I'd slept only 7 hours total in the past 3 nights. We were out of the 100-mile wilderness. All that was left was the 15-mile runway to the summit of Katahdin. I could finally sleep now. All I'd been able to think about for the past 20 hours was sleeping 4 hours straight, something I hadn't done in days. Days that seemed a lifetime ago.
I was exhausted, but couldn't sleep. On the night of day 46, we were at the flanks of Katahdin. It was amazing and awesome to finally see it, the previously abstract thing that had drawn us all the way from Georgia. I couldn't sleep because Jerker was late. Again. Although we were close to the finish, I was far from confident. Walter and I had covered 8 miles with him that afternoon in about 4 hours. He was moving ridiculously slowly, and every bathroom break seemed to take forever. It was as if he fell asleep every time his feet stopped moving. When the three of us got to Pollywog Stream, where the crew was waiting, it was already dark and well past the time we'd hoped to arrive. I knew Jerker wanted to crawl in the van, but he still had 17 miles to go that night. I was starting to worry about physical limits. But Tove told him he had to get those miles done. He promised him 4 hours of sleep once he reached Golden Road. Ralsei gave him an all-time inspirational pep talk, and if there was any guy who could speak on the topic of sleep deprivation, it was Ralsei. I certainly couldn't be encouraging. I wanted to lock Scott inside Castle Black and drive him far away from this trail. I feared he was doing permanent damage to his body, to his nervous system, to his mind. He was a shell of himself. I had never seen him go this deep and this dark, ever. I remember telling him back in Boulder that I didn't want to see any half-assed effort, and apparently he took that to heart. More than anything, I just wanted him to stop here and sleep. But that's why he had the A-team here. Tove and Chrissy were the masters of triage, fully capable of managing any crisis. They knew how to motivate and push him better than I did. I didn't say anything. All I could do was let the others take control. So late on day 46, when he asked for truck stop-grade stimulants, I suppressed my instinct to yank him aside and tuck him into bed in Castle Black. He was delirious. I think he would have accepted cocaine at that point. Instead, he made do with 2 coconut milk cappuccinos and caffeinated cliff shots and hit the trail again. It hurt me to see him go. It ripped my heart out. My high-priced thoroughbred had become a low-rent donkey. He had been on the trail around the clock for the past 4 days. We didn't have time to talk, so I didn't know where his head was or if it was even still there. Maybe that was for the best. I didn't know how much of his suffering I could handle. I was also dealing with something of my own. Right before we got to the crux of the Kennebec, exactly 8 weeks after my DNC surgery, I finally got my period back. Dr. Flagg had warned me it could be heavier than normal, but I wasn't expecting this. It was like the red wedding scene from Game of Thrones. I was almost worried I'd bleed out in the middle of the wilderness. There was no prospect of finding a doctor or even a shower anywhere. I didn't dare mention it to Jerker, though. I knew he would freak out and end our trip immediately. Thank goodness Chrissy was with me. She drove off and found me some ginormous pads and a laundromat. Fortunately, over the next few days, the bleeding subsided and eventually stopped. With my medical distraction behind me, I was free to focus all my worries on Jerker once again. Did something catastrophic happen? We'd been expecting him for hours, and I grew increasingly anxious. Here on Golden Road, Walter was already passed out in a tent. Kim and Ralsei were sleeping in their rental cars, and I was nervously organizing Castle Black. The sun had already started to rise when Jerker and the night shift finally arrived. I ran out to meet them. Chrissy was in tears. "Jaylu, we pushed him too far. He can't even move. He's tripping on everything. I've never seen him like this before. She was so obviously upset, it scared me. This was the no-holds-barred guidance we needed, yet it was something I couldn't bear to do. Help Jerker hurt himself. Chrissy and Toph's capacity to carry out the mission of all the people who came to help and all those who followed along online was damn near heroic. They were like torchbearers who just ran the final leg into the stadium to ignite the Olympic flame. Jerker was so relieved to see me, he practically collapsed in my arms. Topher calmly walked up to us, and his voice was all business. Here's the deal. You've got 10 miles to the base of Katahdin, and then a 5-mile hike up. You have 11 hours to do that, so you only get 1 hour of sleep here. 1 hour? Jerker balked. You said I could have 4. I nodded. I'd heard that too. Toph had said he could have those precious hours of sleep once he got to Golden Road. You don't believe in me, Toph? You don't think I can do it? You don't think I can sleep for 4 hours and cover the last 15 miles in 7 hours? I could tell Jerker was suddenly offended. How dare Toph doubt the champ? But the champ had taken 8 hours to cover the last 17 miles, so nobody knew what to expect from him. Do you want to sleep, or do you want the record? Topher asked. You get 1 hour. With that, he turned around and walked to the rental car, where, he told me later, he started sobbing, worried that they had pushed him past his breaking point. Jerker spun around and walked toward Castle Black. He looked me straight in the eye and said, "He's fucking crazy." He threw his poles down, and I followed him to the van. What the champ didn't understand was the magnitude of the mountain he needed to climb. It was like he was looking at what the Penobscot tribe called the greatest mountain from the wrong end of a telescope. Toph's out of his mind, he huffed as he labored into the van. Don't wake me up for at least 2 hours.
Chapter 16. Down to the Wire. Day 46. Toph's warning about time must have wormed its way into my unconscious. It rang me awake as surely as any alarm clock, and I didn't even have to set it. My body wanted at least 4 hours, but some part of my mind wanted the record more. The deep autonomic part that keeps the lungs expanding and the heart pumping, the part that keeps each of us moving toward what we need rather than what we think we want. Toph was right. I couldn't spare more hours. When I came to, I sort of blinked myself fully awake and took stock of my world as it came into focus. I could see Jaylu. She was there in the van with me, keeping quiet as she gathered up my stuff, so I'd be ready to hit the trail. It dawned on me that today was her birthday. It was also the day I'd finish. But not yet. I couldn't think about finishing yet. Until I got out of that van, on the trail, and up Mount Katahdin, it was just another day of grinding. There would be no premature victory celebration. For one more day, I would have to be my primal self, alive only in the present. No futures, no pasts, no different from an animal. The real Elvenado had to come out today. I checked my watch as I got up. It was 6:25 a.m. We weren't out of the woods, not by a long shot. It wasn't any kind of smooth finish that lay ahead of me that day. For most Nobo thru-hikers who are finishing their journey, Katahdin is no cakewalk. There's a campground at the base where they stop to rest and get an early start the next morning. Mount Katahdin is the highest point in Maine. It's a monumental hike. This is why I wanted to finish here, for pure aesthetic reasons and ultimate thru-hike culmination. The climb symbolizes everything that the AT embodies: wildness, grandeur, and grit. My desire to go north on the AT meant that the challenge would extend down to the last stretch, the last mile, the last minute. The path up the final mountain required full-on scrambling. the kind of hike you'd see out west in the Rockies, Cascades, or Sierras. Boulders and rocks cover the scarp. As I'd done through most of Maine, I'd have to pick my way carefully up the slope, one safe footfall after another. As I got out of the van, I saw Kim and Toph studying a map of Katahdin and the surrounding area. The fact that everyone was still on high alert, still strategizing, reinforced what I already knew. We had work to do, and quickly. My body reluctantly came to. Every joint felt a rusty stiffness with movements happening in slow motion. Running was an impossible notion. Walking sounded better. Walking seemed more doable. Even on the very last day, I thought about how sweet it would be just to walk it in. Toph's sixth sense for slacking must have kicked in, because he came over to me and started delivering the hard facts of what I faced that day. I was struck by how calm he was, since what he was saying was so impossible sounding. It sounded just as impossible as before my 60-minute catnap. "If you start in 15 minutes," he said, glancing at his watch, "you'll have almost exactly 10 hours to reach the summit. The base of the mountain is 9 miles away, and then you'll have a 5-mile climb. It's gonna be tough, but it's not like you can't handle it. It would be awesome if you can keep 3 to 4 miles per hour. Even given how you feel now, that should be within your range." He didn't mention that my pace last night had been much slower than that. And he didn't need to. Toph was direct, always. But he never said more than he had to. However, there was one thing I absolutely had to say. With joy. Jaylu came over to me and I embraced her. "Happy birthday." She hugged me back and looked at me like today was the best day of her life. I wished I could bottle her optimism, so I could take sips from it forever. I thought about something I'd said to her so many days and states and miles ago, back in Virginia. "If it comes down to hours, then you can get mad at me." I'd been so confident then. But she wasn't mad at me. She just wanted me to get the record. I was suddenly overwhelmed with admiration for her, and with empathy for what she'd been through. "Not yet, though," I told myself. "Not yet. There'd be time for feelings at the summit." Jaylu had to drive the van to the park entrance to get the spot she'd reserved. We had one last moment before she took off. The next 10 miles really were the linchpin to the whole FKT attempt, and none of us knew if I could actually do it. We were in totally unknown territory in terms of my body and fatigue. So when Jaylu asked me who I wanted to run with that morning, I knew my choice was critical. Chrissy and Toph were out. They were too tired from the night before. What I really needed was a trail boss. Someone to beat the drum and keep me moving forward no matter what. Luckily, Special Forces had arrived the night before, a total surprise, and he was more than ready for that job. So I picked him and Walter. It felt like I was choosing warriors more than runners. We were going into our last battle. Jenny took off in Castle Black. Walter and Special Forces and I started moving. No theatrics, no rituals, no nothing. We just started moving slowly north. We crossed the Penobscot River over Able Bridge, an unforgettable milestone for every Nobo thru-hiker. The rushing water breathed life energy into me. It represented another passage to the end. But there was something better up above. Katahdin loomed. It was right there in front of us. All we had to do was keep moving forward, and then moving up. I looked at Walter, and I could see that he knew the space my head was in. Like a soft suggestion, he asked, "Should we jog?" I didn't want to, but his words fired up my legs and miraculously made them move. It was like when a song comes on the radio that stirs a certain emotion, and you can't help but dance. He stirred movement in my legs. As I started running, everything started to click. I know how to do this. Without thinking, I let out a primal scream as I had before the start of so many races when the energy crested within. That's how I dealt with nervousness and excitement. I channeled it into a sound and released it. My stride lengthened and quickened, and I fell into the strong, steady pace that had carried me forward over the past 20 years, and with so many good friends. I remembered something Topher had said to me two nights earlier, when it seemed like the suffering would never end. He'd said that what had impressed him most about me during this torturous challenge was that even after the trail's 2,000 miles had finally broken me, I'd still been kind to strangers and been a good trail steward. I was in the shadow of Katahdin. Walter, Special Forces, and I had made it through the pivotal 10 miles. I would have loved a burst of energy, but it was yet to emerge. What did exist was something more subtle and significant. I had exposed a primordial pathway to a part of myself that transformed my spasms of fear and pain into a fluid waltz of bliss. Broken and obliterated, I felt only ease. Having almost run 2,189 miles, I was hours from setting the new record and felt no worries, only calm, as I started the final ascent. It was the breaking down that built me up.
I didn't want to leave the scene at Golden Road. The momentum was building, and it was powerful. But I knew the longer I stayed, the more likely Jerker would dawdle in the van. Plus, I needed to drive to the park entrance to claim my parking spot. It was a bluebird midsummer Sunday morning, and I knew it would be crowded. Speedgoat had warned me that Baxter State Park was, well, special, to put it nicely. I was about to find out what he meant. Technically, it's not even a state park. It's an independently funded land trust. Most hikers knew Baxter State Park had a long-standing love-hate relationship with thru-hikers. Before we stepped foot in the park, its director penned a letter requesting that the AT be diverted from Katahdin, claiming that thru-hikers were a bunch of rule-breaking, littering young partiers. It was a classic, "Hey, kid! Get off my lawn," kind of letter. Even old Warren Doyle had his beef with the park staff. In 1979, he was arrested for summiting Katahdin in the winter. Rather than pay the $25 fine, he spent the night in jail to call attention to the ridiculousness. In fact, most reasonable people seem to agree that the park's attitude on this front was absurd. The Portland Press Herald wrote that the park official's statements on AT thru-hikers are the latest examples of overzealous park protectionism that is actually harming the park's reputation and, in turn, the local economy. Even so, we were mindful of their rules. Kim had gotten us two parking permits, one for each of our vehicles, ahead of time, just to be safe. I didn't have a working phone, thanks to the water I'd spilled all over it, so I was grateful for the help. When we pulled up to the parking area, with Kim in front of me, two rangers eagerly jumped out of the booth, as if they'd been waiting for us. They talked to Kim for longer than I felt was necessary. I started to wonder if they weren't going to let us in. Eventually, they let Kim pass, and then I pulled up to the booth. The rangers standing outside held a clipboard and examined Castle Black. "No, hi, welcome to our beautiful park," or even a standard, "enjoy your visit." I was greeted with, "Your permit expired at 7 a.m. I looked at the clock on the dashboard. It was 7:05. "I could give your parking space away to somebody else," she warned. I looked behind me. There wasn't a single car in sight. Apparently, this ranger wanted to make sure I knew that she was doing me a favor. I see how this is gonna go. El Coyote, Special Forces, Ralsti, and John Rodrigue were able to obtain parking spots later that morning with no problem. She grudgingly let me enter, and I parked and got dressed to hike up that mountain. This was the day we'd been dreaming of for weeks. We couldn't have asked for better weather or a better crew. I loaded my pack with extra snacks and layers of clothing because I knew this might take a while. I was so giddy, We all were. We eagerly gathered in the parking lot's picnic area, wondering when Jerker would arrive. And shortly after, we heard the roar of a wild animal right before it charges its greatest adversary. The expression on Jerker's face was reminiscent of day one, when I'd seen him at Neil's Gap, looking like a kid again. Today he looked like a man who had just walked away victorious from battle. He knew he'd just killed those 10 miles in under 3 hours. Not fast by normal standards, but he'd basically just crushed it. His face and body emanated confidence. He stood up straight, he didn't stumble, and he had no sense of urgency. The feeling of ease took over, as if he'd just removed his boxing gloves after 12 rounds. In his mind, he knew that he'd done it. The locals weren't as confident. They knew what lay ahead. Standing among my best friends, old and new, as Jerker ran toward me, was like all of the best moments of our journey rolled into one. It brought back memories of everything we'd been through. Even the bad memories felt precious, since those were the times that had made me and Jerker even closer. We'd traveled through so many different places and seen so many new things, in America and in ourselves, that we knew we'd never be quite the same. As I stood there feeling the sun on my face, I thought about all the people who had come to the crossings, even those who had driven me crazy, and I actually wished all of them could be here now. But they were with us in spirit, glued to the live tracker information. The tracking company later told me that they'd had more hits on their website than they'd ever had before, as people constantly hit refresh. Jerker's phone was blowing up. We got a message from Ricky, who was with Speed Goat and other world-class runners at the Hard Rock 100. They were all rooting for us. And there was a message from Scott's blind friend, Thomas, reminding him to close his eyes and see the trail with his mind. People on Facebook were talking conspiracy theories, wondering if Jerker had cut it this close for entertainment's sake. It was a preposterous idea, but I couldn't fault their thinking. To break the Appalachian Trail speed record by a mere 3 hours was highly unlikely. By way of contrast, the margin between the current world record holder in the 100-meter dash and the runner-up is 4 times as large. It was pretty nuts, but trust me, if we could have broken the record by 4 days, as we'd originally planned, we would have. Looking back, I could see we were underprepared and naive. We'd thought we'd have this romantic and healing adventure for our tight family of two, but I realized that we would never be standing here if it weren't for the countless strangers who'd come out to help. They felt like family too, and I felt content. My heart was full. I'd stopped thinking about my yearning for a baby, which had cast a pall over the drive out east. Jerker and I had everything we needed, and more. I had seen this man, who I spent practically every hour with at home, transform into someone I didn't know, and then reemerge as someone better. He'd needed this journey. He'd needed to return to the edge. He had slowly transitioned from ultra-running legend to my domestic dream, and he needed to once again feel what it was like to suffer. Elective suffering is such a strange thing. At its essence, pushing his limits was a way for Jerker to learn more about himself and our relationship. Like Dean Potter once said, I willingly expose myself to death consequence situations in order to predictably enter heightened awareness. And it often leads to a feeling of connectivity with everything. Albeit less extreme, we had gone in searching for heightened awareness and connectivity with ourselves, each other, and the trail. I think that's what drew so many people to follow our journey. It was like Scott was in a fishbowl. People could watch him in his most vulnerable state and laugh at his humiliation and cry at his defeat. They had a feeling of connectedness to what Jerker was doing, as if they were a part of the journey. Back on day two, Jerker had told a reporter that this would be his masterpiece. I'd cringed, but in a way, he was right. He'd gone to the graveyard and come back. He'd messed up and learned along the way. He'd pushed his body beyond what was possible and put it all out there for the world to see. In one sense, it was the most beautiful expression of his running career. As we sign the logbook at the base of Katahdin and again were greeted by several rangers, we both felt that ease that comes at the end of suffering. Topher put away his phone and his apps. Drucker took off his pack and set down his poles. He looked at me and his team and said, "I'm going for a birthday hike with my wife and our best friends."
Chapter 17. The Greatest Mountain. Day 47. Even though I'd climbed higher mountains, explored more scabrous wilderness, and run under bigger skies through more treacherous ground, these were all just lonely superlatives. The best of class is always exclusive, and like those singular experiences that seem to happen only in a world of their own, you can often find yourself there with no accompaniment. This journey was anything but solitary, and, most important, it was this abundance that created such an intensely beautiful and magical experience. And it was not a beauty born of one image. It was like those expansive montages assembled using thousands of striking photos that coalesced to produce another greater image. This was an all-inclusive portrait of every experience. Over a lifetime of hard work and wins and close calls, I built a Wikipedia page's worth of accomplishments. Most of my records have already been broken. Some might never be matched. I say that with humility. I can't match them now. I'm not that runner now. It's undeniable. My old self would smoke my current self almost anywhere in the world and under almost any conditions. Maybe not on the Appalachian Trail, though. As I made my way up the slope, I felt like each step I took had been foreshadowed by the millions of other steps I'd taken. The long path north was about to end. Along the way, it had opened up and activated pathways inside me. If I got the record, it wouldn't be like my other victories. It was something deeper, and in a way, less remarkable. I didn't feel like an ultra runner or someone particularly special. I felt like I'd taken a long route home. It was the final leg on the final day on the greatest mountain, and I savored it. We couldn't have asked for a more bluebird day. I was with Jaylu, surrounded by our friends, and we climbed our way up, taking nothing for granted. As we began the final ascent, I was once again happy for my decision to go north instead of south. The last 5 miles of the trail up to Katahdin are like a grand finale. It's incredible terrain all around. Endless and spare and severe. People up in Maine have long thought that when the sun rises in the east, it hits the summit of Katahdin first. The Penobscot tribe puts the residence of its storm god there, and we'd learned that 40 to 50 mile an hour winds are typical conditions. Not today. Today was perfect. The higher I climbed, the stronger I got. The stronger I got, the easier my stride became. Jaylu laughed as she watched me. I was too tired to be exhausted, or vice versa. We passed a crew of trail workers breaking up rocks with sledgehammers. I stopped and thanked them. Then a group of young hikers came along and giddily formed a human tunnel for me to run through. Others had gathered, having heard today was the day, and they high-fived me as I sprang up and onward. When we passed the first false summit, we checked the time, just to be absolutely sure. It was one more mile to the actual summit, and we had 3 hours and 45 minutes. It struck me that Toph's insistence on 1 hour of sleep for me instead of 4 might well have decided the outcome. I scanned the mass of hikers for him and caught his eye just long enough to telegraph my absolute gratitude. As we drew closer to the famous sign at the summit, I was reminded of the first time I'd seen it, in a photo. When I met Horty, back in the early 2000s. He'd taken me to his office, and hanging on the wall was a poster of a thru-hiker draping himself over the sign. His body language told a complex story, not only of the exultant triumph that fills you with satisfaction and joy, but also of the profound depletion that leaves you hollow and hungry. I'd wondered ever since what it would feel like to finish that same journey and touch that iconic sign. There were tons of people on the peak. No wonder. It was a beautiful summer Sunday. I stopped once to soak in the atmosphere. J.Lew was right behind me, smiling. People started cheering and applauding as we got closer. She waved and motioned for me to keep going. "Go," she yelled. "Go!" "No!" I stuck out my hand for her to grab. "We're going together." It was 2:05 p.m. on July 12, 2015. I'd run the Appalachian Trail in 46 days, 8 hours, and 7 minutes. I had beaten the record by 3 hours and 13 minutes. One by one, our friends came over the top and joined the crowd of strangers, fans, and well-wishers. The summit magnet of Katahdin that had pulled me north was now pulling all of us together. I leaned my face against that weather-worn wooden sign that I'd been dreaming about for thousands of miles. I hugged and kissed J.Lew. The area around the sign had suddenly become wonderfully, happily crowded, and people wanted to know how I felt. I said, "Today is my wife's birthday," and everybody burst into singing "Happy Birthday" to my best friend. A year ago, we had sought peace and healing in the California desert. We'd found just enough to make us want more. I'd had a wild idea born out of frustration and stuckness, and J.Lew had responded to it with both confusion and understanding. Of course she had. She was the secret to my sauce, the salt to my pepper, and being with her had been my luckiest break. I was a better person because of her, and she was the reason I was standing on that mountain. She was also the reason why I might never have begun this journey. J.Lew made my post-racing life rewarding and fun. I had lost the desire to push my body to the edge. I was content, but even complacency has a shelf life. I felt an urge to reconnect with my old self, the one that might not win, but still kept fighting. Up at the top of Katahdin, I realized some of the people who'd gathered there were just starting their 2,000-mile journey south to Springer Mountain. One of them already had a trail name, Frisbee, and I signed her disc, "Get to Springer no matter what." I saw something in Frisbee's eyes that mirrored what J.Lew and I had felt 46 days ago. J.Lew and I had finished our pilgrimage, but we could only wonder what Frisbee would experience. The point of a thru-hike is different for everybody. Some people assume thru-hikers are running away from something, trying to escape the real world. For me, it was transformation. I wanted to find something I thought I'd lost, to test strengths I didn't think I had anymore, to rekindle the fire I'd thought was long extinguished. The journey was the tool I needed to pry myself open. I guess old Horty was right. This is who I am. This is what I do. Epilogue. September 2016. The wind came gently through the old oaks high in Great Smoky Mountains National Park. It felt like an old friend, its sound and its feel and the memories it brought with it. It also felt new to me that day, almost unfamiliar. Our existence is always like this, the same but different, light then dark, found now lost, here and there and back again. Other parts were entirely different. Above me, the nighttime sky held countless points of light and was wide open and cloudless. Nothing like the gray, waterlogged ceiling that hung over most of my days on the AT. All around me, the hint of fall was in the air instead of spring. I wasn't sleepy. I was fully alert. And most pertinent, I wasn't the poor soul just wrapping up day 43 of a certain 2,000-mile journey. Speedgoat was already fast asleep in the shelter. I had just hiked in 30 pounds of food, water, and sleeping gear, including Speedgoat's pillow, 8 miles to provide a few comforts. I knew that kindness. True to his precise planning, this would be his first and only night camping on the trail. He didn't like sleeping on rocks like I had become accustomed to. It was uncanny to have returned to the same grassy meadow where 14 months ago I doubted myself as I drifted off for a quick nap, serenaded by these same rustling oaks. A year had passed. I could hardly believe it. My AT trial had left me gasping for air and grasping for reality. But it had done so much more. Most important, it had tested and honed, tempered, and steeled my bond with Jalu. I was still in awe of what she did for me last year, and suddenly I wanted to share my thoughts and feelings with the person who had joined me along the entire way. I called her that night from Spencefield Shelter. The modern cell signal, both amazing and unnerving in its ubiquity, was crystal clear as I heard her voice answer from across the country. "Jerker, where are you? What's it like? Is it raining yet? Are the bugs bad? Have you seen any sobos?" She loved for me to describe the places the two of us had been, and I indulged her with my observations on how things were the same and how they were so different, too. How the climbs and descents that I limped through in Tennessee were now dusty instead of muddy, and how the hotel where we stayed with Horty and Irwin didn't look as depressing this time. One thing hadn't changed at all, though. The back roads were just as sketchy as she had left them. "Unless that rain dance you've been doing causes a hurricane, he's gonna break our record." She laughed. "That lucky bastard. Third time's a charm. I'm happy for him, and I love that you're there helping out. I just wish I could be there too. I was so looking forward to watching him suffer." She laughed even louder. "Tell him to hurry up. I need you back here to help with the baby." I could hear Raven keening in the background, and my heart went out to both of them, as it always did and always would. She was born Ravenna Lynn Jurek on June 1st, 2016, almost exactly a year after we'd started the trail. "I miss you guys. It feels weird without you. I'll be home soon," I assured her and hung up. I missed them both, but at the same time I loved being out here. It was the middle of nowhere, as almost everyone would agree. But it was also something else for me. It was the middle of myself, the center of my existence, who I am and what I'm a part of, my tribe, my family, and myself. I knew she wasn't worried about my peace of mind after losing the record. I've had all but one of my records broken. They don't mean anything. It's the acts that stand as moments and emblems for ourselves. I used the Farr Davis's record as a device to extract the best out of myself, a goal to keep pulling me forward. You train not to beat other people, but to beat time and previous performances. I've always thought of trails as veins on the surface of the earth. There was so much to learn from running and sharing these wilderness passages as they crisscrossed through ranges and canyons like blood vessels spanning the continent. Each section of the trail became a volume in my living body of knowledge that was drafted by Mother Nature. Horty and Speedgoat wrote a few pages too, as did everyone else who had shared even a moment of the AT with me. That's why I had to go help Carl. I had my piece to write for him as well. I had my own wisdom now, and it was my responsibility to pass it on. And like the progression from student to teacher, it is the passing along of that assistance, counsel, and perseverance that moves us all forward. For several months after my run, my legs felt heavy, while I quickly regained the weight I'd lost. And then some, as Jalu liked to point out. To be safe, we both took antibiotics for Lyme disease and checked to make sure no major damage had been done to my nervous system. Nothing to worry about. I bounced back and my energy returned. In January, I received a New Year's postcard from Frisbee, stating she'd made it to Springer exactly 6 months after she descended Katahdin, and she'd carried that Frisbee the whole way. The runner I'd snapped at in the whites caught me at the Boston Marathon Expo the next spring. As I apologized profusely, he just laughed and said, "I shouldn't have asked how you were doing, since the answer was written on your face." I grimaced again. My body healed. I became what I was before I'd started running north. I returned to normal physically, but I wasn't so sure about my intellectual and spiritual components. Could I ever be the same after such a pilgrimage into my deepest self? Doubt lingered on after we finished. Perhaps Timmy said it best when offering a pop psychology assessment of my post-run state. After such a beautiful and brutal odyssey, that white trailblaze is branded onto his soul forever. I had nothing to add to that. I still don't. People often ask what getting to the other side provided and why I did it. And beyond the predictable and polite, I find it difficult to really say. Why would anyone volunteer for such suffering? One theory that I embraced after a certain newcomer graced my life is that undergoing something like the FKT attempt was kind of like producing offspring. I wouldn't know what it was like until I went ahead and did it. On the other hand, I'm still figuring out fatherhood, so I'm not sure that really tracks either. Maybe the whole thing was one long and muddy Zen cone, and only through considering it in the first place could I begin to comprehend the unanswerable. I remember Timmy telling me about a presentation he gave at a university, where a professor's child suddenly raised his hand as an image of the yin and yang symbol appeared. When Timmy called on the precocious youth, he asked what color the line was between the black and white sides. The little Buddha was onto something. The line exists, but now I think I know that you have to start walking it to figure out what it really looks like. Ultimately, it doesn't matter if I ever know exactly what it all was. The adventure was as much about what I saw and who I met while hiking on the trail as it was about the perceptions that I discovered within myself, and I suspect that those impressions will endure longer than anything else. Much more a life course than a race course, the entire 2,000-mile line north truly was my greatest reward. We've already taken Raven on lots of long hikes, including one across the Grand Canyon, and I'm sure she'll get interested in some of the outdoorsy things we do. As she gets older, we'll tell her about how we ran and hiked all the way up America, from the bottom to the top along a major trail artery, faster than anybody else ever had. She'll probably want to know why, but I doubt we'll be able to tell her in a way that makes total sense, because her own sense of why will be very different. That's how it should be. Out there in the wild, on a long journey, you hike your own hike, blaze your own trail, and only you can find what you're looking for. Acknowledgements. Like completing the AT, this book required a collective of talented, wise, and supportive individuals to get me to the end. My buddy Aaron Ralston says it took me 46 days to complete the trail, but 46 months to write about it. Not quite, but close. At a point when I was struggling with this project, a musician friend told me, "You have your whole life to write your first album, and then you're expected to write the second one in 6 months." And I could relate. Thank you to my literary agent, Richard Pine, for never giving up on me. Richard had been faithfully prodding me for years to write another book. Every once in a while, he would send me an email to check in. One afternoon while I was hobbling through Virginia, Richard wrote, "I've been following your trip. This adventure could very well be its own book." Thank you to the crew at Inkwell Management. William Callahan, you are an alchemist, and you helped turn my muddled thoughts into gold. To Tracy Bihar, Ian Strauss, and the team at Little Brown, I know we drove you nuts, but we work best under pressure. Thank you for always giving us one more day, one last tweak, one final edit to make things right. And to Timmy O'Neill, You have fought for us like no other human being ever has. You went to war with me in the Green Tunnel and in the Writing Pain Cave. I am forever grateful to you for helping me remember and being able to describe the feelings and the sounds and emotions of the Wild AT. I owe you a debt that I hope to repay when you write your book. Thank you to Christopher McDougall for your guidance as always. Somehow, your abstract and wacky ideas make sense. The beautiful maps are by Jeremy Collins, the only person we wanted to bring that 2,000-mile line to life. Luis Escobar, thanks for continually answering your phone when I call. You are a master of light, and your photos bring us back to the trail so we all can relive the emotions of every moment. The heavy lifting happened at night. Thank you to all my trail compatriots who followed me into the dark, carrying camping gear and keeping me from sleepwalking off the edge. Andrew Drummond, Timmy O'Neill, Gabe Flanders, Tristan Williams, Ryan and Christina Welts, Nate Sennell, John Rodrigue, Joe Robleski, Chris Clemens, Mark Godale, Aaron Ralston, and Walter Edwards. To Topher and Kim Gaylord, and to Chrissy Mayle, you guys were the missing pieces to the final act. You redefined what friendship means when you answered my SOS call and came to help. David Horton and Carl Meltzer, your guidance and enthusiasm were taken to heart, and I am fortunate to have you on my squad. Even if your early morning, "Let's go to Maine, boy," wake-up calls and nickels and dimes drove me to the brink. To everybody who did some miles with me, to my fellow thru-hikers, to the trail angels, to the people who came out to see me at trailheads, and to everyone following online, you got me 2,189 miles north. To Dean Potter, I wish we had come to the valley before you took your last flight, and I wish Raven could have met you and seen your magic. The world feels so much darker without your light. We miss you, a constant inspiration, even on the other side. Fly free, brother. And to Jenny, this book is for you, because of you, and is you. There is no one else I'd rather walk through the fire with. You are my perpetually rising sun, my warrior, my endless source of inspiration and joy. I spent a lifetime wandering, and when the path led me to you, I finally found my direction. This has been a Hachette audio production of North, Finding My Way While Running the Appalachian Trail. Written by Scott Jurek with Jenny Jurek. Read by Scott Jurek and Jenny Jurek. This program includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF. Produced by Lisa Kahn. Directed by Jeremy Wesley. Recorded at Coop Studios, Boulder, Colorado by Tess Van Lannen and Taylor Marvin. Post-production by A1 Sound Studio. North is available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Scott Jurek. Audio production copyright 2018 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you'd like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.